long macrame keychain dangling from the ignition. She tosses her plank through the window of the taxi, dives in after it. She's small, opening the door is optional. Climbs in behind the driver's seat, sinking into a deep nest of wooden beads and air fresheners, grinds the motor and takes off. Backward. Headed for the rear parking lot. The car was pointed outward in taxicab style, ready for a quick getaway, which would be fine if she were by herself. But there is Hero to think of. The radio is screaming, alive with hollered bursts of taxi lingo. She backs all the way around behind the buy and fly. The back lot is strangely quiet and empty. She shifts into drive and blasts back the way she came. The Jeeks haven't quite had time to react, or expecting her to come out the other way. She screams it to a halt right next to Hero, who has already had the presence of mind to put his sword back in its scabbard. He dives in the passenger side window. Then she stops paying attention to him. She's got other stuff to look at, such as whether she's going to get broadsided as she pulls out onto the road. She doesn't get broadsided, though a car has to squeal around her. She guns it out onto the highway. It responds as only an ancient taxicab will. The only problem being that half a dozen other ancient taxicabs are now following them. Something is pressing against YT's left thigh. She looks down. It is a remarkably huge revolver in a net bag hanging on the door panel. She has to find some place to pull into. If she could find a Nova Sicilia franchulate, that would do it. The Mafia owes her one. Or a New South Africa, which she hates. But the New South Africans hate Jeeks even more. Scratch that. Hero is black, or at least part black. Can't take him into New South Africa. And because YT is a cock, they can't go to Medizania. Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, Hero says. Half mile ahead on the right. Nice thinking. But they won't let you in with your swords, will they? Yes, he says. Because I'm a citizen. Then she sees it. The sign stands out because it is a rare one. Don't see many of these. It is a green and blue sign, soothing and calm in a glare-torn franchise ghetto. It says, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. Explosive noise from in back. Her head smacks into the whiplash arrester. Another taxi rear-ended them. And she screams into the parking lot of Mr. Lee's doing 75. The security system doesn't even have time to res her visa and drop the STD. So it's severe tire damage all the way. Those bald radials are left behind on the spikes. Sparking along on four naked rims, she shrieks to a stop on the lawn grid, which doubles as carbon dioxide-eating turf, an impervious parking lot. She and Hero climb out of the car. Hero is grinning wildly, pinioned in the crossfire of a dozen red laser beams scanning him from every direction at once. The Hong Kong robot security system is checking him out. Her too. She looks down to see the lasers scribbling across her chest.
Welcome to Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, Mr. Protagonist, the security system says through a PA speaker. And welcome to your guest, Ms. YT.
The other taxis have stopped in formation along the curb. Several of them overshot the Hong Kong franchise and had to back up a block or so, a barrage of doors thunking shut. Some of them don't bother, just leave the engines running and the doors wide open. Three Jeeks linger on the sidewalk, eyeing the tire shreds impaled on spikes, long streaks of neoprene sprouting steel and fiberglass hairs like ruined toupees. One of them has a revolver in his hand, pointed straight down at the sidewalk. Four more Jeeks run up to join them. YT counts two more revolvers and a pump shotgun. Any more of these guys and they'll be able to form a government. They step carefully over the spikes and onto the lush Hong Kong long grid. As they do, the lasers appear once more. The Jeeks turn all red and grainy for a second. Then something different happens. Lights come on. The security system wants better illumination on these people. Hong Kong franchulates are famous for their lawn grids, whoever heard of a lawn you could park on, and for their antennas. They all look like NASA research facilities with their antennas. Some of them are satellite uplinks pointed at the sky, but some of them, tiny little antennas, are pointed at the ground, at the lawn grid. YT does not really get this, but these small antennas are millimeter wave radar transceivers. Like any other radar, they are good at picking up metallic objects. Unlike the radar in an air traffic control center, they can res fine details. The res of a system is only as fine as its wavelength. Since the wavelength of this radar is about a millimeter, it can see the fillings in your teeth, the grommets in your Converse high tops, the rivets in your Levi's. It can calculate the value of your pocket change. Seeing guns is not a problem. This thing can even tell if the guns are loaded and with what sort of ammunition. That is an important function, because guns are illegal in Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. It doesn't seem polite to hang around and gawk over the fact that David's computer crashed. A lot of the younger hackers are doing just that, as a way of showing all the other hackers how knowledgeable they are. Hiro shrugs it off and turns back in the direction of the Rockstar Quadrant. He still wants to see Sushi K's hairdo. But his path is being blocked by the Nipponese man, the neo-traditional, the guy with the swords. He's facing off against Hiro about 2 sword lengths apart, and it doesn't look like he intends to move. Hiro does the polite thing. He bows at the waist, straightens up. The businessman does the much less polite thing. He looks Hiro rather carefully up and down, then returns the bow, sort of. "These," the businessman says. "Very nice."
"Thank you, sir. Please feel free to converse in Nipponese if you prefer."
"This is what your avatar wears. You do not carry such weapons in reality," the businessman says, in English.
"I'm sorry to be difficult, but in fact I do carry such weapons in reality," Hiro says.
"Exactly like these?"
"Exactly."
"These are ancient weapons, then," the businessman says.
"Yes, I believe they are."
"How did you come to be in possession of such important family heirlooms from Nippon?" the businessman says.
Hiro knows the subtext here. "What do you use those swords for, boy? Slicing watermelon?" "They are now my family heirlooms," Hiro says. "My father won them."
"Won them? Gambling?"
"Single combat. It was a struggle between my father and a Nipponese officer. The story is quite complicated."
"Please excuse me if I have misinterpreted your story," the businessman says. "But I was under the impression that men of your race were not allowed to fight during that war."
"Your impression is correct," Hiro says. "My father was a truck driver."
"Then how did he come to be in hand-to-hand combat with a Nipponese officer?"
"The incident took place outside a prisoner of war camp," Hiro says. "My father and another prisoner tried to escape. They were pursued by a number of Nipponese soldiers and the officer who owned these swords."
"Your story is very difficult to believe," the businessman says, "because your father could not have survived such an escape long enough to pass the swords on to his son. Nippon is an island nation. There is nowhere he could have escaped to."
"This happened very late in the war," Hiro says, "and this camp was just outside of Nagasaki." The businessman chokes, reddens, nearly loses it. His left hand reaches up to grip the scabbard of his sword. Hiro looks around. Suddenly, they are in the center of an open circle of people some 10 yards across.
"Do you think that the manner in which you came to possess these swords was honorable?" the businessman says.
"If I did not, I would long since have returned them," Hiro says.
"Then you will not object to losing them in the same fashion," the businessman says.
"Nor will you object to losing yours," Hiro says. The businessman reaches across his body with his right hand, grips the handle of his sword just below the guard, draws it out, snaps it forward so it's pointing at Hiro, then places his left hand on the grip just below the right. Hiro does the same. Both of them bend their knees, dropping into a low squat while keeping the torso bolt upright, then stand up again and shuffle their feet into the proper stance. Feet parallel, both pointed straight ahead, right foot in front of the left foot. The businessman turns out to have a lot of zanshin. Translating this concept into English is like translating fuckface into Nipponese, but it might translate into emotional intensity in football lingo.
He charges directly at Hiro, hollering at the top of his lungs. The movement actually consists of a very rapid shuffling motion of the feet, so that he stays balanced at all times. At the last moment, he draws the sword up over his head and snaps it down toward Hiro. Hiro brings his own sword up, rotating it around sideways, so that the handle is up high above and to the left of his face, and the blade slopes down and to the right, providing a roof above him. The businessman's blow bounces off this roof like rain, and then Hiro sidesteps to let him go by and snaps the sword down toward his unprotected shoulder. But the businessman is moving too fast, and Hiro's timing is off. The blade cuts behind and to the side of the businessman. Both men wheel to face each other, back up, get back into the stance. Emotional intensity doesn't convey the half of it, of course. It is the kind of coarse and disappointing translation that makes the dismembered bodies of samurai warriors spin in their graves. The word Zanshin is larded down with a lot of other falderal that you have to be Nipponese to understand. And Hiro thinks, frankly, that most of it is pseudo-mystical crap, on the same level as his old high school football coach exhorting his men to play at 110%. The businessman makes another attack. This one is pretty straightforward. A quick shuffling approach, and then a snapping cut in the direction of Hiro's ribcage. Hiro parries it. Now, Hiro knows something about this businessman, namely, that like most Nipponese sword fighters, all he knows is kendo. Kendo is to real samurai sword fighting what fencing is to real swashbuckling. An attempt to take a highly disorganized, chaotic, violent, and brutal conflict and turn it into a cute game. As in fencing, you're only supposed to attack certain parts of the body, the parts that are protected by armor. As in fencing, you're not allowed to kick your opponent in the kneecaps or break a chair over his head. And the judging is totally subjective. In kendo, you can get a good solid hit on your opponent and still not get credit for it, because the judges feel you didn't possess the right amount of zanshin. Hiro doesn't have any zanshin at all. He just wants this over with. The next time the businessman sets up his ear-splitting screech and shuffles toward Hiro, cutting and snapping his blade, Hiro parries the attack, turns around, and cuts both of his legs off just above the knees. The businessman collapses to the floor. It takes a lot of practice to make your avatar move through the metaverse like a real person. When your avatar has just lost its legs, all that skill goes out the window.
"Well, land sakes," Hiro says. "Looky here."
He whips his blade sideways, cutting off both of the businessman's forearms, causing the sword to clatter onto the floor.
"Better fire up the old barbecue, Jemima."
Hiro continues, whipping the sword around sideways, cutting the businessman's body in half just above the navel. Then he leans down so he's looking right into the businessman's face.
"Didn't anyone tell you," he says, losing the dialect, "that I was a hacker?"
Then he hacks the guy's head off. It falls to the floor, does a half roll, and comes to rest staring straight up at the ceiling. So Hiro steps back a couple of paces and mumbles, "Safe." A largish safe, about a meter on a side, materializes just below the ceiling, plummets, and lands directly on the businessman's head. The impact drives both the safe and the head straight down through the floor of the Black Sun, leaving a square hole in the floor, exposing the tunnel system underneath. The rest of the dismembered body is still strewn around the floor. At this moment, a Nipponese businessman somewhere in a nice hotel in London or an office in Tokyo, or even in the first-class lounge of the LATH, the Los Angeles-Tokyo Hypersonic, is sitting in front of his computer, red-faced and sweating, looking at the Black Sun Hall of Fame. He has been cut off from contact with the Black Sun itself, disconnected, as it were, from the metaverse, and is just seeing a two-dimensional display. The top 10 swordsmen of all time are shown along with their photographs. Beneath is a scrolling list of numbers and names, starting with number 11. He can scroll down the list if he wants to find his own ranking. The screen helpfully informs him that he is currently ranked number 863 out of 890 people who have ever participated in a sword fight in the Black Sun. Number 1, the name and the photograph on the top of the list, belongs to Hiroaki Protagonist.
Amalagin sa bandam kanukari asus. seeing who it is.
12. Ing Security Industries Semi-Autonomous Guard Unit Number A367 lives in a pleasant black-and-white metaverse where porterhouse steaks grow on trees, dangling at head level from low branches, and blood-drenched frisbees fly through the crisp, cool air for no reason at all until you catch them. He has a little yard all to himself. It has a fence around it. He knows he can't jump over the fence. He's never actually tried to jump it because he knows he can't. He doesn't go into the yard unless he has to. It's hot out there. He has an important job. Protect the yard. Sometimes people come in and out of the yard. Most of the time they are good people, and he doesn't bother them. He doesn't know why they are good people. He just knows it. Sometimes they are bad people, and he has to do bad things to them to make them go away. This is fitting and proper. Out in the world beyond his yard, there are other yards with other doggies just like him. These aren't nasty dogs. They are all his friends. The closest neighbor doggy is far away, farther than he can see, but he can hear the doggy bark sometimes when a bad person approaches his yard. He can hear other neighbor doggies too, a whole pack of them, stretching off into the distance in all directions. He belongs to a big pack of nice doggies. He and the other nice doggies bark whenever a stranger comes into their yard or even near it. The stranger doesn't hear him, but all the other doggies in the pack do. If they live nearby, they get excited. They wake up and get ready to do bad things to that stranger if he should try to come into their yard. When a neighbor doggy barks at a stranger, pictures and sounds and smells come into his mind along with the bark. He suddenly knows what that stranger looks like, what he smells like, how he sounds. Then, if that stranger should come anywhere near his yard, he will recognize him. He will help spread the bark along to other nice doggies so that the entire pack can all be prepared to fight the stranger. Tonight, semi-autonomous guard unit number A-367 is barking. He is not just passing some other doggies' bark to the pack. He is barking because he feels very excited about things that are happening in his yard. First, two people came in. This made him excited because they came in very fast. Their hearts are beating quickly, and they are sweating, and they smell scared. He looked at these two people to see if they were carrying bad things. The little one is carrying things that are a little naughty, but not really bad. The big one is carrying some pretty bad things. But he knows somehow that the big one is okay. He belongs in this yard. He is not a stranger. He lives here. And the little one is his guest. Still, he senses there is something exciting happening. He starts to bark. The people in the yard don't hear him barking, but all the other nice doggies in the pack far away hear him, and when they do, they see these two scared nice people, smell them, and hear them. Then more people come into his yard. They are also excited. He can hear their hearts beating. Saliva floods his mouth as he smells the hot, salty blood pumping through their arteries. These people are excited and angry and just a little bit scared. They don't live here. They are strangers. He doesn't like strangers very much. He looks at them and sees that they are carrying three revolvers, a .38 caliber and two .357 magnums, that the .38 is loaded with hollow points, one of the .357s is loaded with Teflon bullets and has also been cocked, and that the pump shotgun is loaded with buckshot and already has a shell chambered, plus four more shells in its magazine. The things that the strangers are carrying are bad, scary things. He gets excited. He gets angry. He gets a little bit scared, but he likes being scared. To him, it is the same thing as being excited. Really, he has only two emotions, sleeping and adrenaline overdrive. The bad stranger with the shotgun is raising his weapon. It is an utterly terrible thing. A lot of bad, excited strangers are invading his yard with evil things, come to hurt the nice visitors. He barely has time to bark out a warning to the other nice doggies before he launches himself from his doghouse, propelled on a white-hot jet of pure, feral emotion. In Whitey's peripheral vision, she sees a brief flash, hears a clunking noise. She looks over in that direction to see that the source of the light is a sort of doggy door built into the side of the Hong Kong franchise. The doggy door has, in the very recent past, been slammed open by something coming from the inside, headed for the lawn grid with the speed and determination of a howitzer shell. As all of this registers in YT's mind, she begins to hear the shouting of the Jeeks. This shouting is not angry and not scared either. No one has had time to get scared yet. It is the shouting of someone who has just had a bucket of ice water dumped over his head. This shouting is still getting underway. She is still turning her head to look at the Jeeks when the doggy door emits another burst of light. Her eyes flick that away. She thinks that she saw something, a long round shadow cross-sectioned in the light for a blurry instant as the door was being slammed inward. But when her eyes focus on it, she sees nothing except the oscillating door, same as before. These are the only impressions left in her mind, except for one more detail. A train of sparks that danced across the lawn grid from the doggy door to the Jeeks and back again during this 1 second event, like a skyrocket glancing across the lot. People say that the rat thing runs on four legs. Perhaps the claws on its robot legs made those sparks as they were digging into the lawn grid for traction. The Jeeks are all in motion. Some of them have just been body slammed into the lawn grid and are still bouncing and rolling. Others are still in mid-collapse. They are unarmed. They are reaching to grip their gun hands with the opposite hands still hollering, though now their voices are tinged with a certain amount of fear. One of them has had his trousers torn from the waistband all the way down to the ankle, and a strip of fabric is trailing out across the lot as though he had his pocket picked by something that was in too much of a hurry to let go of the actual pocket before it left. Maybe this guy had a knife in his pocket. There is no blood anywhere. The rat thing is precise. Still, they hold their hands and holler. Maybe it's true what they say, that the rat thing gives you an electrical shock when it wants you to let go of something. "Look out," she hears herself saying. "They got guns." Hiro turns and grins at her. His teeth are very white and straight. He has a sharp grin, a carnivore's grin. "No, they don't. Guns are illegal in Hong Kong, remember?"
"They had guns just a second ago,"
YT says, bulging her eyes and shaking her head. "The rat thing has them now," Hiro says. The Jeeks all decide they better leave. They run out and get into their taxis and take off, tires a-squeal. YT backs the taxi on its rims out over the SCD and into the street, where she grindingly parallel parks it. She goes back into the Hong Kong franchise, a nebula of aromatic freshness trailing behind her like the tail of a comet. She is thinking, oddly enough, about what it would be like to climb into the back of the car with Hiro Protagonist for a while. Pretty nice, probably. But she'd have to take out the dentata, and this isn't the place. Besides, anyone decent enough to come help her escape from the clink probably has some kind of scruples about boffing 15-year-old girls.
"That was nice of you," he says, nodding at the parked taxi. "Are you going to pay for his tires, too?"
"No, are you?"
"I'm having some cash flow problems."
She stands there in the middle of the Hong Kong lawn grid. They look each other up and down carefully.
"I called my boyfriend, but he flaked out on me," she says.
"Another thrasher?"
"The same."
"You made the same mistake I made once," he says.
"What's that?"
"Mixing business with pleasure. Going out with a colleague. It gets very confusing."
"Yeah, I see what you mean."
She's not exactly sure what a colleague is.
"I was thinking that we should be partners," she says.
She's expecting him to laugh at her, but instead he grins and nods his head slightly.
"The same thing occurred to me,
but I'd have to think about how it would work." She is astounded that he would actually be thinking this. Then she gets the sap factor under control and realizes he's waffling, which means he's probably lying. This is probably going to end with him trying to get her into bed.
"I gotta go," she says. "Gotta get home."
Now we'll see how fast he loses interest in the partnership concept. She turns her back on him. Suddenly, they are impaled on Hong Kong robot spotlights one more time. YT feels a sharp bruising pain in her ribs as though someone punched her, but it wasn't Hiro. He's an unpredictable freak who carries swords, but she can smell chick punchers a mile off.
"Ow!"
she says, twisting away from the impact. She looks down to see a small, heavy object bouncing on the ground at their feet. Out in the street, an ancient taxi squeals its tires, getting the hell out of there. A Jeep is hanging out the rear window, shaking his fist at them. He must have thrown a rock at her. Except, it's not a rock. The heavy thing at her feet, the thing that just bounced off of Whitey's ribcage, is a hand grenade. She stares for a second, recognizing it. A well-known cartoon icon made real. Then her feet get knocked out from under her, too fast really to hurt. And just when she's getting reoriented to that, there is a painfully loud bang from another part of the parking lot. And then everything finally stops long enough to be seen and understood. The rat thing has stopped, which they never do. It's part of their mystery that you never get to see them. They move so fast. No one knows what they look like. No one, except for YT and Hero now. It's bigger than she imagined. The body is Rottweiler-sized, segmented into overlapping hard plates like those of a rhinoceros. The legs are long, curled way up to deliver power like a cheetah's. It must be the tail that makes people refer to it as a rat thing, because that's the only rat-like part, incredibly long and flexible. But it looks like a rat's tail with the flesh eaten away by acid, because it just consists of segments, hundreds of them, neatly plugged together like vertebrae. "Jesus H. Christ!" Hero says. And she knows from that he's never seen one either. Right now, the tail is coiled and piled around on top of the rat thing's body like a rope that has fallen out of a tree. Parts of it are trying to move. Other parts of it look dead and inert. The legs are moving one by one, spasmodically, not acting in concert. The whole thing just looks terribly wrong, like footage of an airplane that has had its tail blown off, trying to maneuver for a landing. Even someone who is not an engineer can see that it has gone all perverse and twisted. The tail writhes and lashes like a snake, uncoils itself, rises up off the rat thing's body, gets out of the way of its legs. But still, the legs have problems. It can't get itself up. YT, Hero is saying, don't. She does. One footstep at a time, she approaches the rat thing. It's dangerous in case you hadn't noticed, Hero says, following her a few paces behind. They say it has biological components.
Biological components?
Animal parts, so it might be unpredictable. She likes animals. She keeps walking. She's seeing it better now. It's not all armor and muscle. A lot of it actually looks kind of flimsy. It has short, stubby, wing-like things projecting from its body. A big one from each shoulder, and a row of smaller ones down the length of its spine, like on a stegosaurus. Her night visions tell her that these things are hot enough to bake pizzas on. As she approaches, they seem to unfold and grow. They are blooming like flowers in an educational film, spreading and unfolding to reveal a fine, complicated internal structure that has been all collapsed together inside. Each stubby wing splits off into little miniature copies of itself, and each of those in turn splits off into more smaller copies and so on, forever. The smallest ones are just tiny bits of foil, so small that from a distance the edges look fuzzy. It is continuing to get hotter. The little wings are almost red-hot now. YT slides her goggles up onto her forehead and cups her hands around her face to block out the surrounding lights. And, sure enough, she can see them beginning to make a dull brownish glow, like an electric stove element that has just been turned on. The grass underneath the rat thing is beginning to smoke. Careful. Supposedly they have really nasty isotopes inside, Hero says behind her. He has come up a little closer now, but he's still hanging way back.
What's an isotope?
A radioactive substance that makes heat. That's its energy source.
How do you turn it off?
You don't. It keeps making heat until it melts. YT is only a few feet away from the rat thing now, and she can feel the heat on her cheeks. The wings have unfolded as far as they can go. At their roots, they are a bright yellow-orange, fading out through red and brown to their delicate edges, which are still dark. The acrid smoke of the burning grass obscures some of the details. She thinks, the edges of the wings look like something I've seen before.
They look like the thin metal vanes that run up the outside of a window air conditioner. The ones that you can write your name in by mashing them down with your finger. Or like the radiator on a car. The fan blows air over the radiator to cool off the engine.
It's got radiators, she says. The rat thing has got radiators to cool off.
She's gathering intel right at this very moment. But it's not cooling off. It's just getting hotter. YT surfs through traffic jams for a living. That's her economic niche, beating the traffic. And she knows that a car doesn't boil over when it is speeding down an open freeway. It boils over when it is stopped in traffic. Because when it sits still, not enough air is being blown over the radiator. That's what's happening to the rat thing right now. It has to keep moving, keep forcing air over its radiators, or else it overheats and melts down.
Cool, she says. I wonder if it's going to blow up or what.
The body converges to a sharp nose. In the front, it bends down sharply, and there is a black glass canopy raked sharply like the windshield of a fighter plane. If the rat thing has eyes, this is where it looks out. Under that, where the jaw should be, are the remains of some kind of mechanical stuff that has been mostly blown off by the explosion of the grenade. The black glass windshield, or face mask, or whatever you call it, has a hole blown through it, big enough that YT could put her hand through. On the other side of that hole, it's dark, and she can't see much, especially so close to the bright orange glare coming from the radiators. But she can see that red stuff is coming out from inside. And it ain't no Dexron 2. The rat thing is hurt, and it's bleeding.
This thing is real, she says. It's got blood in its veins.
She's thinking, this is intel. This is intel. I can make money off of this with my partner, my pod, Hero. Then she thinks, the poor thing is burning itself alive. Don't do it. Don't touch it, YT, Hero says. She steps right up to it, flips her goggles down to protect her face from the heat. The rat thing's legs stop their spasmodic movements as though waiting for her. She bends down and grabs its front legs. They react, tightening their pushrod muscles against the pull of her hands. It's exactly like grabbing a dog by the front legs and asking it to dance. This thing is alive. It reacts to her. She knows. She looks up at Hero just to make sure he's taking this all in. He is.
Jerk, she says. I stick my neck out and say I want to be your partner and you say you want to think about it? What's your problem? I'm not good enough to work with you?
She leans back and begins dragging the rat thing backward across the lawn grid. It's incredibly light. No wonder it can run so fast. She could pick it up if she felt like burning herself alive. As she drags it backward toward the doggy door, it brands a blackened, smoking trail into the lawn grid. She can see steam rising up out of her coverall, old sweat and stuff boiling out of the fabric. She's small enough to fit through the doggy door, another thing she can do and Hero can't. Usually these things are locked. She's tried to mess with them, but this one is opened. Inside the franchise is bright, white, robot-polished floors. A few feet from the doggy door is what looks like a black washing machine. This is the rat thing's hutch, where it lurks in darkness and privacy, waiting for a job to do. It is wired into the franchise by a thick cable coming out of the wall. Right now, the hutch's door is hanging open, which is another thing she's never seen before, and steam is rolling out from inside of it. Not steam, cold stuff, like when you open your freezer door on a humid day. She pushes the rat thing into its hutch. Some kind of cold liquid sprays out of all the walls and bursts into steam before it even reaches the rat thing's body. And the steam comes blasting out the front of the hutch so powerfully that it knocks her on her ass. The long tail is strung out the front of the hutch, across the floor and out through the doggy door. She picks up part of it, the sharp, machine-tooled edges of its vertebrae pinching her gloves. Suddenly it tenses, comes alive, vibrates for a second. She jerks her hands back. The tail shoots back inside the hutch like a rubber band snapping. She can't even see it move. Then the hutch door slams shut. A janitor robot, a Hoover with a brain, hums out of another doorway to clean the long streaks of blood off the floor. Above her, hanging on the foyer wall facing the main entrance, is a framed poster with a garland of well-browned jasmine blossoms hung around it. It consists of a photo of the wildly grinning Mr. Lee with the usual statement underneath.
Welcome. It is my pleasure to welcome all quality folks to visiting of Hong Kong. Whether seriously in business or on a fun-loving hijink, make yourself totally homely in this meager environment. If any aspect is not utterly harmonious, gratefully bring it to my notice and I shall strive to earn your satisfaction. We of Greater Hong Kong take many prides in our tiny nation's extravagant growth. The ones who saw our isle as a morsel of Red China's pleasure have struck their faces in keen astonishment to see many great so-called powers of the olden guard reel in dismay before our leaping strides and charged-up hustling, freewheeling idiom of high-tech personal accomplishment and betterment of all peoples. The potentials of all ethnic races and anthropologies to merge under a banner of the three principles to follow. Number one, information, information, information. Number two, totally fair marketeering. Number three, strict ecology. Have been peerless in the history of economic strife. Who would disdain to subscribe under this flowing banner? If you have not attained your Hong Kong citizenship, apply for a passport now. In this month, the usual fee of 100 Hong Kong dollars will be kindly neglected. Fill out a coupon below now. If coupons are lacking, dial 1-800-HONG-KONG instantly to apply from the help of our wizened operators. Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong is a private, wholly extraterritorial, sovereign, quasi-national entity not recognized by any other nationalities and in no way affiliated with the former Crown Colony of Hong Kong, which is part of the People's Republic of China. The People's Republic of China admits or accepts no responsibility for Mr. Lee, the government of Greater Hong Kong, or any of the citizens thereof, or for any violations of local law, personal injury, or property damage occurring in territories, buildings, municipalities, institutions, or real estate owned, occupied, or claimed by Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. Join us instantly. Your enterprising partner, Mr. Lee.
Back in his cool little house, Semi-autonomous guard unit number A-367 is howling. Outside in the yard, it was very hot, and he felt bad. Whenever he is out in the yard, he gets hot unless he keeps running. When he got hurt and had to lie down for a long time, he felt hotter than he had ever been before. Now he doesn't feel hot anymore, but he is still hurt. He is howling his injured howl. He is telling all the neighbor doggies that he needs help. They feel sad and upset and repeat his howl and pass it along to all the rest of the doggies. Soon he hears the vet's car approaching. The nice vet will come and make him feel better. He starts barking again. He is telling all the other doggies about how the bad strangers came and hurt him, and how hot it was out in the yard when he had to lie down, and how the nice girl helped him and took him back to his cool house. Right in front of the Hong Kong franchise, YT notices a black town car that has been sitting there for a while. She doesn't have to see the plates to know it's Mafia. Only the Mafia drives cars like that. The windows are blackened, but she knows someone's in there keeping an eye on her. How do they do it? You see these town cars everywhere, but you never see them move, never see them get any place. She's not even sure they have engines in them.
Okay. Sorry, Hero says. I keep my own thing going, but we have a partnership for any intel you can dig up. 50-50 split.
Deal,
she says, climbing onto her plank. Call me anytime. You have my card.
Hey, that reminds me. Your card said you're into the 3 M's of software?
Yeah. Music, movies, and microcode.
You heard of Vitaly Chernobyl and the Meltdowns?
No. Is that a band?
Yeah. It's the greatest band. You should check it out, homeboy. It's going to be the next big thing. She coasts out onto the road and poons an Audi with Blooming Green's license plates. It ought to take her home. Mom's probably in bed, pretending to sleep, being worried. Half a block from the entrance of Blooming Green's, she unpoons the Audi and coasts into a McDonald's. She goes into the ladies. It has a hung ceiling. She stands on the seat of the third toilet, pushes up on one of the ceiling tiles, moves it aside. A cotton sleeve tumbles out, bearing a delicate floral print. She pulls on it and hauls down the whole ensemble. The blouse, the pleated skirt, underwear from Vicky's, the leather shoes, the necklace and earrings, even a fucking purse. She takes off her Radicaea's coverall, wads it up, sticks it into the ceiling, replaces the loose tile. Then she puts on the ensemble. Now she looks just like she did when she had breakfast with Mom this morning. She carries her plank down the street to Blooming Green's, where it's legal to carry them, but not to put them on the crete. She flashes her passport at the border post, walks a quarter of a mile down crisp new sidewalks, and up to the house where the porch light is on. Mom's sitting in the den in front of her computer as usual. Mom works for the feds. Feds don't make much money, but they have to work hard to show their loyalty. YT goes in and looks at her mother, who has slumped down in her chair, put her hands around her face almost like she's voguing, put bare-stockinged feet up. She wears these awful cheap fed stockings that are like scouring cloth, and when she walks, her thighs rub together underneath her skirt and make a rasping noise. There is a heavy-duty Ziploc bag on the table, full of water that used to be ice a couple of hours ago. YT looks at Mom's left arm. She has rolled up her sleeve to expose the fresh bruise just above her elbow where they put the blood pressure cuff. Weekly fed polygraph test. "Is that you?" Mom shouts, not realizing that YT's in the room. YT retreats into the kitchen so she won't surprise her mother. "Yeah, Mom," she shouts back. "How was your day?" "I'm tired," Mom says. It's what she always says. YT pinches a beer from the fridge and starts running a hot bath. It makes a roaring sound that relaxes her, like the white noise generator on Mom's nightstand. The Nipponese businessman lies cut in segments on the Black Sun's floor. Surprisingly, he looks so real when he's in one piece. No flesh, blood, or organs are visible through the new cross-sections that Hero's sword made through his body. He is nothing more than a thin shell of epidermis, an incredibly complex inflatable doll. But the air does not rush out of him. He fails to collapse, and you can look into the aperture of a sword cut and see, instead of bones and meat, the back of the skin on the other side. It breaks the metaphor. The avatar is not acting like a real body. It reminds all the Black Sun's patrons that they are living in a fantasy world. People hate to be reminded of this. When Hero wrote the Black Sun's sword-fighting algorithms, code that was later picked up and adopted by the entire metaverse, he discovered that there was no good way to handle the aftermath. Avatars are not supposed to die, not supposed to fall apart. The creators of the metaverse had not been morbid enough to foresee a demand for this kind of thing. But the whole point of a sword fight is to cut someone up and kill them. So Hero had to clutch something together in order that the metaverse would not, over time, become littered with inert, dismembered avatars that never decayed. So the first thing that happens when someone loses a sword fight is that his computer gets disconnected from the global network that is the metaverse. He gets chucked right out of the system. It is the closest simulation of death that the metaverse can offer, but all it really does is cause the user a lot of annoyance. Furthermore, the user finds that he can't get back into the metaverse for a few minutes. He can't log back on. This is because his avatar, dismembered, is still in the metaverse, and it's a rule that your avatar can't exist in two places at once. So the user can't get back in until his avatar has been disposed of. Disposal of hacked-up avatars is taken care of by graveyard demons, a new metaverse feature that Hero had to invent. They are small, lithe persons swathed in black, like ninjas, not even their eyes showing. They are quiet and efficient.
Even as Hiro is stepping back from the hacked-up body of his former opponent, they are emerging from invisible trap doors in the Black Sun's floor, climbing up out of the netherworld, converging on the fallen businessman. Within seconds, they have stashed the body parts into black bags. Then they climb back down through their secret trap doors and vanish into hidden tunnels beneath the Black Sun's floor. A couple of curious patrons try to follow them, try to pry open the trap doors, but their avatar's fingers find nothing but smooth matte black. The tunnel system is accessible only to the graveyard demons, and, incidentally, to Hiro, but he rarely uses it. The graveyard demons will take the avatar to the pyre, an eternal underground bonfire beneath the center of the Black Sun, and burn it. As soon as the flames consume the avatar, it will vanish from the metaverse, and then its owner will be able to sign on as usual, creating a new avatar to run around in. But hopefully, he will be more cautious and polite the next time around. Hiro looks up into the circle of applauding, whistling, and cheering avatars and notes that they are fading out. The entire Black Sun now looks like it is being projected on gauze. On the other side of that gauze, bright lights shine through, overwhelming the image. Then it disappears entirely. He peels off his goggles and finds himself standing in the parking lot of the U Storit, holding a naked katana. The sun has just gone down. A couple of dozen people are standing around him at a great distance, shielding themselves behind parked cars, awaiting his next move. Most of them are pretty scared, but a few of them are just plain excited. Vitaly Chernobyl is standing in the open door of their 20x30. His hairdo is backlighted. It has been petrified by means of egg whites and other proteins. These substances refract the light and throw off tiny little spectral fragments, a cluster-bombed rainbow. Right now, a miniature image of the Black Sun is being projected onto Vitaly's ass by Hiro's computer. He is rocking unsteadily from foot to foot, as though standing on both of them at the same time is too complicated to deal with this early in the day, and he hasn't decided which one to use.
"You're blocking me," Hiro says.
"It's time to go," Vitaly says.
"You're telling me it's time to go? I've been waiting for you to wake up for an hour."
As Hiro approaches, Vitaly watches his sword uncertainly. Vitaly's eyes are dry and red, and on his lower lip he is sporting a chancre the size of a tangerine.
"Did you win your sword fight?"
"Of course I won the fucking sword fight," Hiro says. "I'm the greatest sword fighter in the world."
"And you wrote the software."
"Yeah, that too," Hiro says.
After Vitaly Chernobyl and the Meltdowns arrived in Long Beach on one of those hijacked ex-Soviet refugee freighters, they fanned out across Southern California looking for expanses of reinforced concrete that were as vast and barren as the ones they had left behind in Kiev. They weren't homesick. They needed such environments in order to practice their art. The LA River was a natural sight, and there were plenty of nice overpasses. All they had to do was follow skateboarders to the secret places they had long since discovered. Thrashers and nuclear fuzz grunge collectives thrive in the same environment. That's where Vitaly and Hiro are going right now. Vitaly has a really old VW Vanagon, the kind with a pop top that turns it into a makeshift camper. He used to live in it, staying on the street or in various snooze and cruise franchises, until he met up with Hiro Protagonist. Now the ownership of the Vanagon is subject to dispute because Vitaly owes Hiro more money than it is technically worth, so they share it. They drive the Vanagon around to the other side of the U-Storit, honking the horn and flashing the lights in order to shoo 100 little kids away from the loading dock. It's not a playground, kids. They pick their way down a broad corridor, excusing themselves every inch of the way as they step over little Mayan encampments and Buddhist shrines and white trash stoned on vertigo, apple pie, fuzzy buzzy, narthex, mustard, and the like. The floor needs sweeping. Used syringes, crack vials, charred spoons, pipe stems. There are also many little tubes, about thumb-sized, transparent plastic with a red cap on one end. They might be crack vials, but the caps are still on them, and pipettes wouldn't be so fastidious as to replace the lid on an empty vial. It must be something new Hero hasn't heard of before. The McDonald's Styrofoam burger box of drug containers. They push through a fire door into another section of the used storage, which looks the same as the last one. Everything looks the same in America. There are no transitions now. Vitaly owns the third locker on the right, a puny 5x10 that he is actually using for its intended purpose, storage. Vitaly steps up to the door and commences trying to remember the combination to the padlock, which involves a certain amount of random guessing. Finally, the lock snaps and pops open. Vitaly shoots the bolt and swings the door open, sweeping a clean half-circle through the drug paraphernalia. Most of the 5x10 is occupied by a couple of large, four-wheeled flatbed handcarts piled high with speakers and amps. Hero and Vitaly wheel the carts down to the loading dock, put the stuff into the van again, and then return the empty carts to the 5x10. Technically, the carts are community property, but no one believes that. The drive to the scene of the concert is long, made longer by the fact that Vitaly, rejecting the technocentric LA view of the universe in which speed is God, likes to stay on the surface and drive at about 35 miles per hour. Traffic is not great either, so Hero jacks his computer into the cigarette lighter and goggles into the metaverse. He is no longer connected to the network by a fiber optic cable, and so all his communication with the outside world has to take place via radio waves, which are much slower and less reliable. Going into the black sun would not be practical. It would look and sound terrible, and the other patrons would look at him as if he were some kind of black and white person. But there's no problem with going into his office, because that's generated within the guts of his computer, which is sitting on his lap. He doesn't need any communication with the outside world for that. He materializes in his office, in his nice little house in the old hacker neighborhood just off the street. It is all quite Nipponese. Tatami mats cover the floor. His desk is a great ruddy slab of rough-sawn mahogany. Silvery cloud light filters through rice paper walls. A panel in front of him slides open to reveal a garden, complete with babbling brook and steelhead trout jumping out from time to time to grab flies. Technically speaking, the pond should be full of carp, but Hero is American enough to think of carp as inedible dinosaurs that sit on the bottom and eat sewage. There is something new, a globe about the size of a grapefruit, a perfectly detailed rendition of planet Earth, hanging in space at arm's length in front of his eyes. Hero has heard about this, but never seen it. It is a piece of CIC software, called simply Earth. It is the user interface that CIC uses to keep track of every bit of spatial information that it owns. All the maps, weather data, architectural plans, and satellite surveillance stuff. Hero has been thinking that in a few years, if he does really well in the Intel biz, maybe he will make enough money to subscribe to Earth and get this thing in his office. Now, it is suddenly here, free of charge. The only explanation he can come up with is that Juanita must have given it to him. But first things first. The Babel Infocalypse card is still in his avatar's pocket. He takes it out. One of the rice paper panels that make up the walls of his office slides open. On the other side of it, Hero can see a large, dimly lit room that wasn't there before. Apparently, Juanita came in and made a major addition to his house as well. A man walks into the office. The librarian demon looks like a pleasant, 50-ish, silver-haired, bearded man with bright blue eyes, wearing a V-neck sweater over a work shirt, with a coarsely woven, tweedy-looking wool tie. The tie is loosened, the sleeves pushed up. Even though he's just a piece of software, he has reason to be cheerful. He can move through the nearly infinite stacks of information in the library with the agility of a spider dancing across a vast web of cross-references. The librarian is the only piece of CIC software that costs even more than Earth. The only thing he can't do is think.
"Yes, sir,"
the librarian says. He is eager without being obnoxiously chipper. He clasps his hands behind his back, rocks forward slightly on the balls of his feet, raises his eyebrows expectantly over his half-glasses.
"Babel's a city in Babylon, right?"
"It was a legendary city," the librarian says.
Babel is a biblical term for Babylon. The word is Semitic. Bab means gate, and El means God. So Babel means gate of God. But it is probably also somewhat onomatopoeic, imitating someone who speaks in an incomprehensible tongue.
The Bible is full of puns. They built a tower to heaven and God knocked it down.
This is an anthology of common misconceptions. God did not do anything to the tower itself. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. Genesis 11:6-9, Revised Standard Version.
So the tower wasn't knocked down, it just went on hiatus.
Correct. It was not knocked down.
But that's bogus.
Bogus?
Provably false. Juanita believes that nothing is provably true or provably false in the Bible. Because if it's provably false, then the Bible is a lie. And if it's provably true, then the existence of God is proven and there's no room for faith. The Babel story is provably false because if they built a tower to heaven and God didn't knock it down, then it would still be around somewhere, or at least a visible remnant of it.
In assuming that it was very tall, you are relying on an obsolete reading. The tower is described literally as its top with the heavens. For many centuries, this was interpreted to mean that its top was so high that it was in the heavens. But in the last century or so, as actual Babylonian ziggurats have been excavated, astrological diagrams, pictures of the heavens, have been found inscribed into their tops.
Oh, okay. So the real story is that a tower was built with heavenly diagrams carved into its top, which is far more plausible than a tower that reaches to the heavens.
More than plausible, the librarian reminds him. Such structures have actually been found.
Anyway, you're saying that when God got angry and came down on them, the tower itself wasn't affected, but they had to stop building the tower because of an informational disaster. They couldn't talk to each other.
Disaster is an astrological term meaning bad star, the librarian points out. Sorry, but due to my internal structure, I'm a sucker for non sequiturs.
That's okay, really, Hero says. You're a pretty decent piece of ware. Who wrote you anyway?
For the most part, I write myself, the librarian says. That is, I have the innate ability to learn from experience. But this ability was originally coded into me by my creator.
Who wrote you? Maybe I know him, Hero says. I know a lot of hackers.
I was not coded by a professional hacker per se, but by a researcher at the Library of Congress who taught himself how to code, the librarian says. He devoted himself to the common problem of sifting through vast amounts of irrelevant detail in order to find significant gems of information. His name was Dr. Emmanuel Lagos.
I've heard the name, Hero says. So he was kind of a meta-librarian. That's funny. I guessed he was one of those old CIA spooks who hangs around in the CIC.
He never worked with the CIA.
Okay, let's get some work done. Look up every piece of free information in the library that contains L. Bob Reif and arrange it in chronological order. The emphasis here is on free.
Television and newspapers, yes, sir. One moment, sir, the librarian says.
He turns around and exits on crepe soles. Hero turns his attention to Earth. The level of detail is fantastic. The resolution, the clarity, just the look of it, tells Hero or anyone else who knows computers that this piece of software is some heavy shit. It's not just continents and oceans.
It looks exactly like the Earth would look from a point in geosynchronous orbit directly above L.A., complete with weather systems, vast spinning galaxies of clouds hovering just above the surface of the globe, casting gray shadows on the oceans, and polar ice caps.